and welcome to another edition of The Brand Called You. This is a global podcast in which I'm going to be talking to some of my favorite thought leaders, intellectuals, creative thinkers from all over the world. Obviously, today is no exception. Our guest is Dr. Yael Danieli. She's not only a clinical psychologist, but a victimologist and a traumatologist. I don't think Dr. Danieli has any idea how much she personally has influenced my life, but she did. In the 1990s, the early 1990s, I attended a conference of children of survivors, of which I am. I'm the child of a Holocaust survivor. And I heard Dr. Danieli speak, and it resonated so profoundly with me because for the first time, I realized that not only was my mother a Holocaust survivor, a victim of the war, but actually we, the children, my brother and I, had inherited trauma too. And it was really the beginning of a kind of deconstruction process for me and a rebuilding. And I have in large measure to thank Dr. Danieli for starting me off on that journey. Just a little bit about her. There's so much to tell, but I'll choose my favorite bits. She started the first program to help Holocaust survivors and their children called the Group Project for Holocaust Survivors and Their Children. And then over the years, she's had so many roles, including a consultant to the World Health Organization, to UNICEF, to the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and various governments on trauma and victim survivors' rights and optimal care. She's a distinguished professor of international psychology at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. And perhaps, and maybe for her, the most interesting right now, the founder and executive director of the International Center for Multigenerational Legacies of Trauma. So I know there's much more I could talk about you, but welcome, welcome. You know, as I mentioned, you know, I was in the dark for a long time. I know that like so many children who have inherited the trauma of their parents, it takes a while for us to understand it, to even know what has gone on. It's so assimilated into our very being. And that's really what happened with me. What fascinates me is, I mean, you stayed with this. It's clearly a passion of yours. And I'm sort of curious why you became interested in it professionally in the first place. I know a little bit about your background, but maybe you can tell me what drove you to create a life in which you wanted to help the children of traumatized parents and multi-generations of trauma.
Trauma has been part of our world. I was born in the then-to-be Israel, to become Israel. I'm actually older than one of my countries, which is a particular privilege of my generation and a few before us. And my mother's family, my mother ended up being the sole survivor of her family that remained in Europe. My father's family too, those who didn't manage to escape were all perished. That was actually the fate of most of the people I grew up near or with. That my parents were involved with.
So in Israel, you were living among Holocaust survivors?
No, it was those who managed to escape first. And right. Then the survivors who, bless God, survived. And then also when Israel, the night Israel was announced and created, the war started, or the first war started, the War of Independence, first of seven that in my life I went through as long as I lived in Israel, and many more after I have come to New York to earn my doctorate in clinical psychology at New York University, and then also followed in work with the United Nations. But let me go back a little. In my studies, I took my studies very seriously because my doctorate very seriously because I grew up on the European tradition of your doctorate having to be your master opus. And I really was looking for something of great meaning. And I asked myself, what kept us around in the 20th century after such a horrible century in many ways? There were aspects of it that were wonderful too, but what kept us around? Why do we keep trying the world? Why do we keep giving the world a chance? And the only answer I came up with is hope. And I therefore chose to study the psychology of hope. What does hope mean to people? And that was the subject of my first doctoral dissertation, in which I interviewed people, all my students and my colleagues interviewed all kinds of people, including from a minimal challenge to hope, such as a seemingly minimal challenge to hope, such as missing a bus, all the way to surviving concentration camps, being a prisoner of war, or being diagnosed with terminal illness. Now I'm talking about the 1960s. Okay, so this is before anybody spoke. Actually, so let me share with you that my students and colleagues took the what seemed to be easy challenges. I took on what seemed to be the most severe. Why am I saying seemingly? Because my students immediately learned that when they stood in a subway stop, in a bus stop or subway stop, and saw people who missed it, the last one, and interviewed them, what are they experiencing? For some of them, it might mean that they lose their job. For some of them, it might mean they lose the last plane to see their dying mother. So they immediately became mature, learning that things are not necessarily as they seem. The meaning hidden underneath is so much more profound, or could be. On the other hand, you can do the opposite too, by the way. Things that seem very important end up being trivial, but at any rate, or seemingly trivial. I took on, as I mentioned, Holocaust survivors, terminally diagnosed patients, and prisoners of war, or POWs, as it's called. And it was very interesting because in those days, people would say to me, they don't talk to anybody. Why do you think they would talk to you? And everybody thought I was being somewhat in la la land. Well, you know from your history, but anyone who knows, of course, I would come to a survivor. I also believe when I study, I believe in studying where things happen, not only in my office. So it was important to me to reach out to people and be in their homes. So typically I would get to a survivor's home. I would not speak to them about the terminally diagnosed people, although that's a whole other amazing story to tell. Or I will not speak about the POWs who, I will focus on the Holocaust survivors today. So I would come typically to a survivor's home after work. As you would know, where would they put me? In the kitchen. in the kitchen. And those people who were supposed to not speak to anybody, more often than not, kept me there overnight until the middle of the next day sometimes. They couldn't stop speaking. It's as if they waited all these years to find someone who really wanted to learn, who really wanted to listen. Here I came to learn about hope. And what I learned about was what I then termed the conspiracy of silence. Let me explain. Without exception, and that is not a scientific result that is frequent, 100%. Without exception, every survivor said to me, no one would want to listen to me. No one would understand me unless they went through the same experience. Not even psychotherapists, not even lawyers. No one wanted to listen. I was a very idealistic graduate student. I hope I did not lose my idealism many years later. And it occurred to me that I'm learning something that must be studied. I called it the conspiracy of silence. I wanted to understand how come a society who's supposed to care for its members was not there to help or to show concern. That psychotherapists, that doctors, psychiatrists, who by contract are there to listen. Because if they don't listen, they don't understand, and therefore they can't help. How come they don't listen? Or shush survivors, shut them up. I was quite in severe pain and quite a bit of outrage with that piece of very difficult learning, very difficult knowledge. But I set out to study it nonetheless. So I changed the focus on my original dissertation from the psychology of hope. I did write about it for those of you who are interested, but to studying the conspiracy of silence. What are the difficulties in listening? I found at least 40 ways of not listening. We are experts. Human beings are experts in not listening when things are scary or painful or we experience them as too painful to bear or to take in. So as a researcher, that became my focus. As a clinician, I built the group project for Holocaust survivors and their children with colleagues who are survivors themselves, who felt the same way, that survivors needed to be listened to, needed to speak. And we built together the group project for Holocaust survivors and their children. Why did we call it group project? Because we immediately understood that in our training, we were not trained to listen to trauma. We were hoping then that survivors would teach us to listen. We then created groups where survivors, they told us, right, that only others who went through the same experience can listen. So we created groups as the main modality for allowing the voices of survivors and the exchange and the creation of a community. We also didn't want to call it mental health because we didn't want the assumption of craziness. Remember, I'm talking in the 60s, beginning 70s. This is before mental health became more acceptable. Right. And we were those who promoted mental health. But in those days, people, when you talked about mental health, people thought, people, or therapy, they thought you're crazy.
As my mother would say, that's for crazy people.
Exactly. Not only, they also didn't trust doctors because of their experiences during the war. During the war, doctors such as Mengele, you know, chose who to die and how to experiment on them and who to live for whatever short while. So there was a lot to learn. There were so many challenges, but our hearts remained open. We supported each other in listening, in not letting ourselves be too wounded to become deaf. Not only during the research, but children clamored and said, we too, we also have legacies from this. Listen to us too. So it became the group project to Holocaust survivors and their children. And we had all kinds of groups, survivors, children, spouses of children, spouses of survivors who were not survivors.
But I have a question, because you'll maybe not find this so interesting, but you know, I did a performance about being the child of a Holocaust survivor. I'm a professional storyteller. And at one point, ARD, German television, came to interview me about my show. And they asked if they could speak to my mother. So the Germans came into my mother's home. And the only time, the first time I ever heard her story, was when she happily and willingly told it to the German TV executive. So what she denied me, she was happily and easily willing to give to the German, the enemy. She was always absolutely unwilling to tell me anything, would walk out of the room. I had to pick up her story through clues, you know, found with the 40 chickens hidden in the freezer every night, or, you know, the tears that would fall for no reason, our Hebrew names that were given to us. So in case we had to flee the country, they would be easily translatable. I mean, you know, it was a house of secrets for me. And so I guess what I'm wondering about is that necessarily universal that they all want to tell? Is the conspiracy of silence also in the silence that they often withhold information from their children, for example?
Thank you for sharing this story with me, because it's not an unusual story, as you might have learned. Look, parents love their children. They want to protect them from anything. Mm. Any eventuality in living. And so when you're saying she denied you the story, of course, as a child, you resented that too. That's totally understandable. But she, from her point of view, she most likely, I don't know your mother, so I should not speak for her. But from her point of view, just out of love, she wanted to protect you, to make sure that your world is free of that horrible, terrifying human cataclysm. She was probably hoping that your world will be an, quote, normal one without the knowledge of evil, as she had no choice at experiencing. What I didn't say before, exactly for the same reason probably, was survivors would say, no one would listen to me unless they went through the same experience. Even a Nazi would understand what I mean more than others.
I actually thought, I really thought that. I came to the same conclusion. I really did. But I have a question, because obviously you're working with children of war victims of many stripes, not just Holocaust. And I always suspected in my mother's case, and I wonder if this is universal, I always suspected that she was almost like a sealed up boat. And that if she talked, that it would be like putting a hole in the boat where the water would come in and there would be no escaping. In other words, is it possible that for some survivors, silence is actually their only way to sanity and mental health?
Sanity and mental health are words. Sanity is okay. I would keep mental health for the moment out of that.
Fair enough. But is silence
simply,
often...
Simply because, See, in my writings, and that is another thing I do want to share with you and your audience, and we are jumping way ahead to the last decade of my life. So let me go there to answer in a roundabout way. In the advent of the internet, in between, I've written quite a bit about these issues, and not only about all of these issues in survivors' lives, but also about, what I named the survivor's attempt at living after the Holocaust. I named it post-trauma adaptational styes. Why styes, plural? Because of course, every individual is unique. We can never talk about all survivors behaving the same way. That was a great mistake at the beginning of the field. People wanted to have a survivor syndrome with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we don't have to think about it anymore. People even wrote about the child of survivor syndrome. And I said, wait a minute, what I see is not a syndrome. I see a whole lot of people individually struggling with how to live with their history. Not only how to telling me how they survive, but how do they live with what they had lived through. So that's this plural, that is styles. Why adaptational styles? Because they had to adapt to life through trauma and to life after trauma, okay? So I sort of dedicated my thinking in my career less so with particular symptoms, which of course I know about and I've learned. I created, for example, with others, the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies, and considered a pioneer in the field of trauma in general. But I have been more interested in how people live. And in the children's, in terms of the children, how do children live history? Notice I'm saying live history, not even live with history, right? You are actually living history.
Explain.
That's what you're telling me. You're telling me that the Holocaust is a part of you. Whether you think about it or not, whether you know about it or not, whether your mother tried to shield you from it or not, it is a part of you.
Is that what you mean when you reference in your writing historical trauma?
The term historical trauma was actually termed by Maria Yellow Horse. sorry, it's empty. By this time of day, I talk too much. Maria Braveheart, Yellow Horse Braveheart, who is an American Indian. And it caught on. And she, in her writings, attempts to define it, to describe it. I find it not necessarily helpful.
Okay, the living history.
That's okay, because other people find it helpful.
But living history is
so something. It is in my big book. Yes. I'll tell you about my big book in a minute. we're going around and around. So let me go back to why did I do this book?
Because living history. I'm living history.
Well, let's hold off on that. You as the interviewer are responsible for bringing me back to that. Okay, so let me go back just to give people sort of a more coherent, perhaps. So I described what the survivors went through as post-trauma adaptational styles and described the consequences of the for the children. Of the adaptational styles I described, the most important and the ones that were corroborated by data are the victim style, that is people who behave like they're a victim right now, all the time. The fighter style, that is people who are ready to guard, to protect all the time. They also come from a different position of feeling more strength to respond and more obligation to respond in a fighting way. The third style I described is the numb style. People who still live as if it happened only yesterday. Each one of these, and the fourth style I described in my writing is quotes, what I call those who made it, in quotation marks. They behave like nothing ever happened. These are the people who they got off the boat, they took the number out of their arms, okay? Or they made a joke, this is my girlfriend's number, or all kinds of ways like that. They dedicated their whole life either to prove that the Holocaust did nothing to them, right? They overcame Hitler, they won, or they devoted their whole life to as a dedication, like Elie Wiesel, for example, to make sure the world learns, the world listens, the world is with us. So I wrote this. I thought I wrote many other things about mourning, about guilt, about survivor's guilt, about shame, about... and at some point, and built the project. So we were working with people all the time, right? And the third mission in my life, from all of that, meeting with the Conspiracy of Silence, was to make sure that victims have rights. And I'm still a total missionary in that. I'm actually a total missionary of all of them. But that is the meaning of victimology, right? Create rights that are acknowledged by international law and applied in national law, that victims have rights. And we succeeded. We really succeeded. It was always controversial, but victims do have rights. I do not want to die before every victim around the world, or potential victim around the world, listen to me everywhere, knows that you have rights. You have rights, and you have ways to make sure that you access those rights. And the United Nations has a way to make sure of that. And the International Criminal Court has ways of ensuring that. And the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has ways to ensure that. So so this is the sort of end 80s, beginning, I became part of course, being a teacher was not only to learn, but also to share with the world. I thought about everyone else who had been traumatized. What can we teach that might be of help? Because having been born and then to become Israel, and being a profoundly committed Jewish woman, I profoundly believe in what in Hebrew we call Mitzion Tetze Torah. That means from Zion, that is Israel, will come Torah, learning will come. So a profoundly believing Jew, when they have a knowledge, they are obligated to share it, so it might help the world. A profoundly proud Jew also believes that knowledge is responsibility, that you're obligated to share it. And also we share a belief that knowledge is liberation, as painful and as terrifying as it may be. It's liberating because it sheds light on what perhaps we could do to help, even if it feels hopeless, even when it feels hopeless.
Yeah.
So this book, that took a long time, as you see, International Handbook for Multi-Generational Legacies of Trauma. As you see, I read it almost every day. It was published in 1998 after many years of work, because I commissioned at least 30 populations around the world to teach the world about what they have learned from their own traumas. So the historical trauma that you referred to before is the first time that Maria wrote about it.
Yael, I wonder if you wouldn't mind me switching the shift slightly, in that I'm the daughter of all scientists, including several neuroscientists, a couple of biochemists. And I, of course, am very interested in, and I know you know researchers like Rachel Yehuda who are studying the inherited epigenetics of trauma. And I wonder how much is out of our control. In other words, how much is a kind of stitched into our epigenetics or into our chemical makeup? And do we really have as much power to change it through therapy, through knowledge, or are we kind of a slave and a victim to our own chemistry?
I'm so glad you brought it up. What Rachel found and company found did not surprise me whatsoever. It was simply a corroboration of what I knew from the experience we have accumulated. I don't understand why the world got so excited about the biological aspect in particular, because life is made of so many other dimensions.
Yeah.
But whatever helps, helps. So the same way indeed. And by the way, I don't want to get into the argument of the total data-based validity of any particular concept, because it's not what we're talking about. But Number one, I'm totally unsurprised. Number two, actually, I invited Rachel at the time when we did this book to contribute a chapter about the promising biological thinking in those days. Okay, the research came afterward. So there is a chapter on that. There's also a chapter on the physiology and the brain functions, etc. Okay, how do I do it as a complete thing? Okay, so we have the epigenetic findings that for me are the corroboration of the psychosocial findings on the biological stratum of life, of the organism. But think a little, think. Since experience is what got us there, experience and good therapy could get us out of there. So again, this is the trouble that people attach so many meanings and they forget that they are attaching all these meanings to things. It's like, if it's biological, oh my God, there's no way out.
I think what you're implying is that it's a delicate dance between nature and nurture, and that each is malleable.
Yeah, that's basically the conclusion. But at the same time, I began a while back to talk to you about in the advent of the internet, remember? Mm-hmm. In the advent of the internet, after I published this book and many other things, I would get emails from people around the world, from India, wanting, for example, to study the legacies of the partition between India and Pakistan, etc., etc. Or from Africa, I want to study my people. In Europe, from all over the world, they want to study their people and understand their. But their doctoral committees refused because there was no measure. I'm talking before Rachel. But also that measure, as I said, is of the biological stratum.
Right.
What these people were talking about is more the psychosocial, the psychological, the family dynamic, the societal dynamics, the cultural dynamics. Mm. What I call living with history. We don't just live on a biological level. Come on, guys, wake up.
Right.
Okay. It's a little more complicated.
Right.
They would say, so I wrote back, I said, I wrote everything I know, you create the measure. But I forgot that when I came to the field, there were maybe 10 books in the area. By the 1970s, 80s, no, by the year 2000, there was thousands of books in the field of trauma. To enter the field today must be a totally overwhelming experience. So my empathy won, and I said, okay, I'll create a measure. So I reached out to the very best researchers I know in the field. They all said yes to me, God bless them. And we created what eventually it took us about 5 to 7 years. We created the Danieli inventory for multi-generational legacies of trauma, which you can find on the website of the International Center for the Study, Prevention, and Treatment of Multi-Generational Legacies of Trauma. If you go to that website, which I love, it's my home, it's my intellectual soul home. And if you go there, you'll find that by now, that inventory has not only been studied to compare Nazi Holocaust survivors, children in North America and Israel, with amazingly meaningful findings. But It's been translated into close to 15 languages. It's been studied in Hungary. It's been studying in France, French. I mean, in all these languages. As we speak, it's being translated into Polish, into Rwanda, into Kenya. Rwanda is the name of the language. And right now, I'm studying with it. We created an international group to study the intergenerational effects of all people around the world who were exposed to nuclear radiation fallout, into nuclear bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah.
So there's so many languages. We studied, young colleagues studied Kosovo. It's translated into Bosnian. It's translated on and on and on into Russian, into Kazakh, into I can go on and on. Live with this. So today, people can learn, can study this, and this inventory is the gold standard of studying. It is database. We have the database for all of the results of all over the world, so we can actually compare and contrast different populations, different groups, different what seems to be, remember the scenes, what seems to be different traumas, to see, in fact, are traumas different or not? Is the world the same? Do cultures make a difference in living with trauma? Do religions make a difference? Politics, all of these dimensions.
I suppose it leads me, I can't believe how fast this time has gone, but a question about the future. I when I was in the second generation world, I noticed a lot of education directors of school districts were children of survivors. And I also noticed they made insanely unhealthy decisions as a result of their own trauma. I remember pulling up to a school in Washington, D.C., a yeshiva, to give a performance. And for Holocaust Memorial Day, they had painted black train tracks on the parking lot and had put Arbeit macht frei over the door of the school, thinking this was just the best activity in the world. And I that's one of about 15 examples of the stuff I saw initiated by unhealthy children of survivors who hadn't gotten into therapy yet with people like you. However, my question is, for example, we're seeing the refugees, Ukrainian refugees, for example, flooding into various countries, Germany, Netherlands, and so forth. And in time, not only the immediate victims of war, but their children will be in positions such as teachers, such as politicians, and they will be making decisions, important decisions for a culture. And I wonder, what should governments or, what should countries be thinking about now as they absorb traumatized people into their culture so that they can somehow navigate these choices that will ultimately be made by these generations?
See, part of what happens with children of survivors, when they explore who they are, and again, in understanding, is they become wise, like what you just sounded like. And
Is there a way we can prepare entire countries?
We can prepare, but part of the results of our studies have direct implications to refugees.
Really?
Of course. To refugees, I believe a good time to study is in refugee, good times to study and to help and to support is during the time of being a refugee. Not to pathologize, not to make every mother feel guilty for the fact that she's a refugee mother and she cannot offer her child everything she believes she should have if she were not a refugee. but provide them with a space where they have compassion, where they have a chance to share, just like the group project. We come back to our early lessons, where they do have a chance to discuss with each other, not only with the host culture, but with each other. Not only to try to become something they're not, but to be with the being that they are, and heal and understand and be compassionate to themselves, and also to provide them with help with their children. They need help.
Yeah.
To be a mother, you want to be a healed woman, to be there fully for your child. And as long as you're very traumatized, as they must be, and worried about their husbands and worried about their homes, if they still have a home, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. Many of my colleagues are very involved in it. Many of my colleagues in Poland, both from Israel and from here and from the host countries, the trauma specialists are involved. But you're absolutely right in demanding that governments get involved, the decision makers. Because the decision makers, and let me explain more deeply about that. I told you I'm a missionary about that stuff. Not only that's part of the mission of the center, to teach decision makers. Decision makers don't only make decisions, they also don't only make decisions about issues, they also determine the budget of what goes into what, and the priorities of the budget, and the values.
Yes.
So absolutely, they themselves have to become experts in what they make decisions about. Most of the time, they have no expertise. And even more serious, there is a particular challenge in being a decision maker in government, which is the length of time you make decisions for. It's what, for 4 years, 8 years,
right,
to remain in office? You don't think lifelong. You don't think generation. People invoke the word generations to come. I'm allergic to that. They invoke the term to be there for our generations and generations to come. But they really make decisions only for now. Am I going to be elected to in the next round in 2022 and 2024?
That's such a good point. Such a good point.
So please, when you decide to become a decision maker, ask yourself, do I understand life? What is my part in history? What is the history I'm living?
Mm.
And therefore, what is the history I'm proposing my children, I'm proposing my land in my country, my folk.
Yeah.
Do I understand what it means?
Yeah.
So we have a great deal to teach. Some decision makers make it their business to learn.
Yeah.
And it's not only the staffer's job. It's their own, and those hopefully become visionaries, and those hopefully become the beacon of light for succeeding generations. But you know, I remember when Putin was elected the last time, the first thing he did, I actually have it recorded, the first words he said It was about generations. And it hit me right in the gut. And he talks about generations now too. And he talks about generation back, right? Peter the Great.
Yeah.
And in the names of those generations, he's willing to destroy country.
Yeah.
A whole country, children and all.
Yeah.
But he believes he's doing it for generations. And my question keeps being, which generations?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who are the generations you feel responsible for?
Right. Past or the future?
Uh-huh.
Right. Right. Uh-huh. I could go on and listen. It's only the beginning.
But by the way, you'll have to, you know, again, I invite all of you to visit our website.
Yes.
Amazing webinars.
We will post all of your wonderful sites, and including any notices about your upcoming webinars, which are riveting. And I'm sorry.
Our upcoming one, as you might remember, is August 9, which is International Day of the World's Indigenous People.
Yes.
And it addresses the tragedy of the residential schools of the Native people.
Yeah. Listen, I can't thank you enough for a lifetime of the most fascinating work. So helpful, so meaningful, and intellectually fascinating for me as well. I realize we only just touched the iceberg, but I can't thank you enough for coming on. And
you'll have to be part of our webinars. We should have something about your show and what you've learned from doing it.
I would love to.
Really, you've learned a lot.
Yeah. Anytime I'm available.
So let's talk.
I would love it. And thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I'll be in touch.
Anytime. This is why God keeps me here.
Lehitra Oat.
Lehitra Oat.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.